The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Die AfD 44% mehr als verdoppelt. Die Linke 9% leichte Verluste. Die SPD 9% ähnlich wie vor 5 Jahren.
Polls have closed in a German election that's set to usher in the first far-right state government since the Second World War. Exit polls are showing Alternative for Germany in the lead with 44% of the vote in the state of Saxony-Anhalt. Well, this is 35-year-old Ulrich Siegmund, the perfume salesman turned politician. Support for Alternative for Germany, or AfD, has increased in recent months. The AfD is known for its anti-immigrant stance.
If you can hear an air raid siren going off in the background, it's because there are activists where I am, next to the Parliament building, who clearly are very unhappy with the results or with the exit polls and are doing this as a way to show their opposition to a potential AfD government. So let's be clear, voting is over. The exit polls suggest the AfD on 44%. Another one says 44.5%. It suggests also the Christian Democrats who've governed this state for 24 years, who govern this country, on their worst ever result in this state, which has previously been seen as the bedrock of Christian democracy, their party, that is, their philosophy, down on 18.5%. That is a massive swing, to use the cephalological term, a swing from the Christian Democrats to the AfD. Crucially, is it enough to give the party a majority of seats in this building behind me? 35-year-old man was once a perfume salesman. He's now smelling what he might call the sweet smell of success. He is the man who has achieved the best electoral performance for the AfD in its history. If the turnout was very high, then there are those who say it is because of his personality, his approach to this campaign. This is a man about whom the Der Spiegel magazine, a respected West German magazine, news magazine, put him as a mugshot on its front page and called him the most dangerous man in Germany.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry, on this Labor Day Monday. And what a weekend, what a Sunday, with the world focused on Germany. And just some really dramatic news out of Germany. But to have the whole world looking at what just one state in Germany, 3% of Germans, what they're going to vote for. I mean, I don't know how big it was in the news over in the United States, but it was front page on the Telegraph here in the UK. The Alternative for Deutschland, this neo-Nazi party winning first place. An absolutely massive, massive election victory for them. And this changes a lot for Germany. So as I record this, we just have exit polls. They indicate that they've won 44.5% of the vote, more than double their nearest rival, the Christian Democratic Union. This particular state, Saxony-Anhalt, they have never had one party kind of win the election outright and be able to govern the whole state without a coalition partner. They've only had this election system since 1990, since they reunified with West Germany because they were part of East Germany. But still, you've never had one party be able to win that state outright, to win that a complete majority in that state. And the AfD might have done it. It's close. It looks like right now, as I record this, that they're actually a little under. So unlike America, unlike Britain, Germany runs a proportional system. In the US or Britain, if the AfD had achieved a result. If any party had won 44.5% of the vote and their nearest rival only had 20, they would have won by a landslide. You know, they would control that state. They would control the state legislature, or they would have appointed the state governor, or however, whatever equivalent it were to be. For Germany, the way it works is you win 44.5% of the vote, and in theory, you get, well, kind of in theory, you get 44.5% of the seats. But any party that gets less than 5% of the votes in that parliament, they get nothing. You know, there's this minimum threshold of 5%. So if you have several smaller parties that all get 5%, well, or less than 5%, then that vote is ignored, and 44.5% can be enough to gain a majority. So a lot of this is going to come down to, well, did one of these small parties, did they get 5.1% of the vote, or did they get 4.99% of the vote, rather than how much the AfD did? That's going to be one of the big deciding factors. But as I mentioned, the current projections show the Alternative for Deutschland receiving 39% of the seats in the state parliament, three short of a majority. Now, you know, why is this a big deal? Why are we so focused on one regional election within Germany? One state election? Well, from a prophetic perspective, this is huge. I think from just a world news perspective, this is huge. That's why it's on the front pages of some of the newspapers here in the UK. You have this Alternative for Deutschland, this extreme, this neo-Nazi party that just won an election. Now, I think this is where it gets a little complex. You get a lot of people, particularly those that are a bit arm's length, in the United States, in Britain, looking at the Alternative for Deutschland and saying, this party's great. I agree with so much of what they're saying. And you look at what they get attacked for, and they get attacked for opposing migration, and they get attacked because they say, well, migration is a bad thing. And they get attacked as well for their support of family values, their opposition to the transgender movement and the LGBT movement. Now, a lot of that is pretty hypocritical. One of the party's co-leaders is a lesbian with a quote-unquote wife. So they're kind of, they're hypocritical on that front. But they at least talk a better talk than a lot of these other parties. They're at least willing to stand up for Germany's children and stand up for biblical morality in that sense, in a way that a lot of other German parties aren't willing to. Even the German parties that have Christian in the name, Christian Democratic Union, Christian Social Union. The Christian Democratic Union just had to fire one of their politicians because he and his homosexual partner paid someone to have a kid for them, which is illegal in Germany. Like, they're a long way from being a Christian Democratic party. So you look at this, and no wonder a lot of people say, well, no, the AfD, they're just Germany's MAGA. That's the Trump movement in Germany. And it's not at all the case. We had an article up on our website over the weekend from Adam Jones. Just, I thought some great research went into this article, called The True Danger of the AfD's Popularity. And he starts with this. Yeah, if you're looking at it, if you look at, well, what does it get criticized for? It gets criticized for those two things most of all. I mean, yeah, if that's all there was to it, that would make me want to support the AfD, or at least think positively of them. I mean, you heard from Mr. Flurry last week talking about the migrant crisis in Spain, the enclave of Ceuta being overrun, all the problems that that's causing, and the AfD talk about that. But one of the things that he digs into is how much, or what they said about history and education in this election. I mean, I think just the fact that they're talking about history in an election is really revealing. You know, if you go to vote for who's going to be the governor of Oklahoma, or if somebody does, you've got an election campaign in any state, in any country, like how history is taught in the schools of Oklahoma, I mean, that's not usually a big part of that race. But here, this is one of the things they were talking about in this election race. And the person that is going to be in charge of education, if the AfD do manage to win outright, and he was somebody who did a lot to kind of write up their platform. He said that the focus on Germany's Nazi past is not good, and he wants to teach more Bismarck, less Hitler. And he said he wants to convey a sense of otherness for the past. You know, he wants Germans to see Nazi history as something very other, something disconnected, something that doesn't have anything for them to learn from. You know, there's no warning. Just look at that Nazi history as just kind of a weird period that has nothing to do with you. That's what he wants to teach young Germans. The party also talks about how they want to change how the nation views Nazi soldiers. Their program for Saxony-Anhalt says fallen soldiers gave their lives to defend their country. Recognizing and honoring this great sacrifice is a first sign of a patriotic turnaround. We want a patriotic turnaround in how we look at our dead Nazi soldiers. That's why, you know, that's what they're saying in a state election campaign. That is important enough for them to put that in their program. We want a patriotic turnaround in how we look at the Nazis. You know, we should be honoring the Nazis. They fought for their homeland. They gave their lives to defend their country. And this is just one small state in Germany, one election. You look at the totality of their rhetoric, what they've said across all of these different states, all of these different elections, they have a lot to say about this subject and about rehabilitating the Nazis. One of their top leaders, Bjorn Höcke, he is called Germany's attempts to commemorate and to apologize for World War II a stupid coping policy. He's condemned Germany for memorializing the Holocaust. He doesn't want memorials to the Holocaust. He's called for a 180-degree reversal on the politics of remembrance. The man who was at the time the AfD's leader, Alexander Gauland. We have the right to be proud of the achievements of the German soldiers in two world wars. Look what our soldiers achieved during World War I and World War II. You know, this is the party that 45% of Saxony-Anhalt just voted for. Yeah, we want to be proud of what our soldiers achieved in World War II. This is a changing Germany. Tino Schiprella, he's one of their current leaders. I find it fundamentally problematic to always link commemoration with the question of guilt. Historical guilt should no longer determine the way we act. Stop feeling guilty. And several of these leaders, I think they're trying to be quite clever about it. They'll use Nazi slogans, but they won't use maybe the ones that are most obvious, or at least in the Western world, the English-speaking world, the ones that we're most familiar with. You know, they're not coming out and saying Sieg Heil or Heil Hitler, but they'll use ones that Germans are very familiar with. But then they'll just back off and kind of, oh, I didn't mean it in that way, when they're attacked on it. And then you look at some of the, I've talked about this magazine before, some of these publications. Compact is a magazine that's written by and for Alternative for Deutschland supporters. And it basically presents a picture of World War II in which, you know, Hitler and Churchill, they're basically as bad as each other. You know, the British Empire, the Nazis, they both had flaws. You know, they have more in common with the woke movement in a lot of ways than they do with MAGA. And so they basically put forward the picture that, well, the Allies won World War II, and so Hitler and the Nazis and the Germans, well, they were unfairly demonized. So they have articles talking about the, quote, unspeakable suffering of the 14 million Germans expelled from Eastern Europe. They talk a lot in the AfD about those Germans expelled from Eastern Europe. And yeah, you know, there was a lot of suffering from Germans at the end of World War II and after World War II, where a lot of Germans had to leave homes that in some cases they'd lived in for generations all across Eastern Europe. It wasn't just Nazis Germans that moved there after the Nazis conquered these countries that got kicked out after World War II. But whose fault was that? Why did they have to leave? You know, it's kind of like all of these, the same people that try to drum up a lot of support for the Palestinians and talk about all the suffering that the Palestinians are having. And a lot of that is exaggerated, like we've seen with this report that actually the people in Gaza are better fed. But again, it's like, well, who caused it? You attack Israel and then you complain that you're suffering when Israel tries to protect itself. Same thing with the AfD. They complain of the suffering of the Germans in the war that they started. Crimes against the Germans, that was a special issue of this Compact magazine. They talked about the mass murderer Winston Churchill in another one. They had a special issue on the so-called death camps of the Americans, which accused Dwight Eisenhower of carrying out the mass execution of German prisoners in 1945. And there are some AfD supporters that are living in an alternative world in which the Nazis are the good guys. Like, this is what is rising up in Germany. Now, not all. I'm sure plenty of AfD voters that are holding their nose and voting for the AfD because they want something done about immigration. But some of those people too are going to start to think, well, you know, the mainstream parties are so badly wrong on migration and they're so badly wrong on family values. Maybe they're really wrong on history as well. Maybe I need to reevaluate. Maybe Hitler wasn't so bad after all. That's what Germany is kind of going through right now. History is repeating itself. And you're getting a lot of people supporting these different groups. So, I mean, this is why when the AfD, they win 50% of the vote, they win, or just under, they win way more than double the nearest rival. They get a victory like no party really has ever had in this particular state in Germany. And they might be able to take over it outright. You know, that is why it is huge news. It is earth-shaking news. And then if you bring in Bible prophecy, it could be even bigger still. So the state of Saxony-Anhalt could now be ungovernable. You might not be able to govern it. It depends a little on how the electoral arithmetic works out. But let's say the AfD do fall short of a majority. Well, the only way to keep them out of power, the only other possible coalition, is everybody except the AfD. We all come together. We all form a big coalition of not the AfD and govern the country. I mean, A, what kind of coalition is that going to be? You have all these different parties that disagree radically on things that are just not the AfD. But also, one of the other parties is the Left Party, which is basically the East German Communist Party. You know, the communists under Stalin killed more people than Hitler. Like, that's a pretty evil party too. So quite understandably, the Christian Democratic Union, well, they say we don't want to do business with the AfD, but we don't want to do business with the Left Party either. Well, based on these election results, if you stick to that, there is no possible government. There's nothing you can do. So that is... That state could just be left ungovernable. What are they going to do there? This is going to cause massive headaches for Friedrich Merz, the chancellor and the leader of the Christian Democratic Union Party, because some of his party members will be saying, well, actually, we do need to work with the AfD. That's the lesser of all the evils presented before us right now, is to go into coalition with the Alternative for Deutschland. Or maybe not go into coalition, but they form a minority government and we vote to support them on things that we agree with. And there'll be a lot of Christian Democratic Union members that are going to be dead against this. So that's one headache. But really, for Merz, this could be the end. We could be about to see Germany lose yet another chancellor. There's another couple of votes coming up on September 20th. Two more elections, two more tests for him. I doubt anyone will push him out of office before then. But he could go. He won the leadership of the Christian Democratic Union. He came to power as the leader of that party saying, I'm going to cut support for the AfD in half. You know, vote for me. I know how to deal with the AfD. And he was the big rival of Angela Merkel for leadership of the Christian Democratic Union party. So he did have quite a lot of credibility to come out and say, look, Angela Merkel created this mess. She invited in all of these migrants. I'm the guy to fix it. Because I was her rival. I disagreed with this policy. I'm going to cut support for the AfD in half. And what happened in this particular state? It more than doubled. Not only, you know, he didn't fail to cut it in half, he cut his own vote in half instead. So he kind of owns this. This is a big personal blow to him. And then only 13% of Germans are satisfied with his performance as Chancellor, according to the latest poll. Only 13%. You know, they don't like him. They want to get rid of him. 85% are dissatisfied. It's a record low, beating the previous record low set by Olaf Scholz, the previous Chancellor. So you could see him resigning by the end of the year. And Germany wouldn't have elections, but there'd be some kind of complex behind-the-scenes negotiations to decide who is the next Chancellor. That's going to be very interesting to watch. I think another aspect of this is a major part of this election campaign was relations with Russia. Which is, again, like, if there's a vote for the governor of Oklahoma, how much is foreign policy a part of that discussion? How much is America's relationship with Russia a part of that discussion? It's not normally a part of the discussion because governor of the state of Oklahoma or the state senate or however it state Congress doesn't have anything to do with foreign policy. It's exactly the same in Saxony-Anhalt in Germany. The state doesn't really have anything to do with foreign policy. But it was a vote winner for the AfD to talk about foreign policy, to talk about we need to draw closer to Russia. There's a big appetite within Germany to split out of the US alliance system and side with Russia. Now, Germany's already working with Russia behind the scenes, and we've written about that, and there's much more than meets the eye to the German-Russian relationship, even right now. It's not like Germany and Russia are kind of the enemies that they portray each other at the moment. But yeah, the AfD want that open break with the United States. They want an open signing with Russia, and not everyone really appreciates the behind-the-scenes negotiations that are going on. So that, I think, is fascinating. We've been forecasting this German-Russian relationship for a long time, and you see the appetite for that within Germans. But the big question that a lot of people rightly are asking, and this is where Bible prophecy really comes in, is can German democracy survive? Right? America and Britain came along and set up West Germany to basically be a Nazi-free democracy. And it was tried to design to have a democracy that kept the Nazis out of power. But what if you have a situation where close to a majority vote for a Nazi-sympathetic party? Like, how does the system deal with that? You can't keep the Nazis out and keep democracy. If you're going to be strictly democratic, the Nazis are in power. All these neo-Nazis, these at least Nazi revisionists. And whatever Germany does, they could be looking at the end of their democracy. Germany's already responded with draconian restrictions on free speech. They've outlawed criticizing or insulting politicians online. And so people will post something like, well, this politician's a liar. They said this here and they changed their minds and they said this later. And then they have the police breaking down their doors. With the AfD's victory, you could see more action coming from the courts, coming from the federal government, potentially up to banning the AfD. But you ban the most popular political party. You ban a political party that got almost 50% of the vote. I mean, are you really a democracy anymore? And then who's making these decisions? Who's making these bans? How can they be held to account? Well, they can't really. They're taking on absolute power. And in this case, maybe it's to keep some neo-Nazis out of office, but how are they going to use that power? I mean, German elites haven't been exactly using it well so far. You go all the way back to one of our earliest trumpet issues, December 1991. Mr. Flurry wrote, "If a real crisis develops, will the Germans call for a new Führer? Your Bible says that is going to happen." Now, half of a German state just voted for that to happen. Let's change our view of Nazi history. Let's have a stronger leader and let's go from there. But as Mr. Flurry's pointed out again and again, you know, the man he's watching to fulfill that role, Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg, you know, the one who seems most likely to fit the role of the coming German strongman, he is not a member of the AfD. He's a member of the Christian Social Union, a satellite party or sister party of the Christian Democratic Union. He's from Germany's mainstream right. So, and we're not necessarily expecting the Alternative for Deutschland to win the federal elections by a landslide and they'll supply the strong leader and we go from there. I mean, the AfD's result, it shows the strong appeal of a charismatic leader, the return of Germany to its roots, to some of this history. But the AfD is probably not going to be the one filling that appetite. And you look at what the Bible says. I mean, Mr. Flurry's made this point. We've put together this montage where just all the times he talks about how the strong leader is going to come into power by flatteries. This is clip one.
Now, he's not going to come in by, let's say, a democratic process. He's going to come in and use flatteries and sort of tweak the democratic process. It says here, something like that, and perhaps take advantage of a weak coalition. But he's going to come in by flatteries. So God sees him, well, not the same way the people see him, but he actually gains that power, hijacks that European superpower by flatteries. He apparently puts together some kind of a small coalition, and that's how he moves into power. I mean, he is unusually adept at flattery. You have to be very intelligent to be able to deceive people in high places with flattery. And he does it magnificently. Well, he was never voted into the office, but he came in, got control of all that power through deceit and flatteries. Now, remember, this is an end-time book, and this is an end-time prophecy. It's going to happen again in this end time. A man is going to come, and through deceit and flatteries, is going to get control of the Holy Roman Empire and its 10 toes, or 10 kings, and not by voting. Even though that is their system today, it is not going to, he's going to come in another way.
This is what the Bible says. Daniel 11 and verse 21, a key passage about this German strong leader. It says the German people will not give him the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. He doesn't just win a vote. He gets in there through machinations, coalition negotiations. He comes into power by flatteries. And now you're seeing German democracy gum up. You see Saxony-Anhalt become ungovernable. There's the prospect of the entire country becoming ungovernable if you have this kind of result nationwide. And people saying, well, maybe we need to step in and interfere with democracy and ban some political parties. And potentially Merz could be stepping down. He might, or be booted out of office, and Germany might lack a chancellor. You could easily have the Daniel 8 man in by the end of the year. The ingredients necessary for this fulfilled prophecy, I mean, they've been present for several years. There have been several opportunities, I think, for us to see this play out, the whole situation in Germany. You know, democracy has just ceased to function for a long time. They haven't had the strong leader that they're desperate for a long time. And so when the time is right, he's going to step in there and he's going to take power by flatteries. So yesterday's vote, it signaled a crisis in German democracy, as well as Germany's appetite for radical change. We could see this strongman very, very quickly. And we do have a free book, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, or a free booklet. You can get that on our website, and that will show you, you know, why does Daniel 11 refer to this strongman? What's that about? Why do we know that Daniel 11, how can you prove that Daniel 11 is talking about the rise of a German strongman? But it's a critical prophecy to understand because it could be fulfilled very, very soon in Germany. And, well, that's going to shake the world. And it's going to impact what happens all around the world. Well, we'll take a quick break. When we get back, we'll look at a bit of a different subject and we'll lift up our eyes and look at some pretty exciting news relating to the heavens. We'll be right back.
Bible prophecy is alive. The events shaping our world right now and in the near future were written down in advance in your Bible. You just need to know where to find those prophecies and how to read them. That's what the Philadelphia Trumpet magazine does for you. Like its predecessor, Herbert W. Armstrong's Plain Truth, The Trumpet shows you how Bible prophecy applies to today's headlines and to your own life. While the world reacts to events as they happen, only The Trumpet magazine shows you where they're headed. It gives you tomorrow's news today. Read or download the latest Philadelphia Trumpet magazine at thetrumpet.com. You can order your free subscription to The Trumpet magazine and hold the hope of Bible prophecy in your hands. Just visit thetrumpet.com for your free subscription. Get tomorrow's news today with the Philadelphia Trumpet at thetrumpet.com.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily. Once again, this is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host. Excited to be with you again and excited to tell you about a new space telescope that launched last week. Now, you may be thinking, well, don't we have an awful lot of impressive space telescopes right now? It seems like we're often hearing about some new initiative, some new one that has launched. And you're right. I think we really live in a golden age of astronomy. We're deluged with incredible pictures. I think so much so that we're a bit desensitized to them. We can kind of take them for granted. And maybe the launch of a new telescope can reinvigorate our enthusiasm for some of these, or remind us of just how incredible it is to have these pictures. But we're going to be deluged even further with incredible pictures from outer space. So, I mean, just in terms of what we have up there so far, so we can understand why this one is different. There's the James Webb Space Telescope, probably the most impressive. This is the one that can see further, that can basically zoom in deeper than any telescope man has ever built. And we've had all of these incredible pictures coming back from the Webb telescope. We've had Webb redo pictures that Hubble did, the deep field images where Hubble just took a pretty narrow patch of sky that seemed dark and empty and zoomed in and showed that there were an incredible number of galaxies. And now Webb has zoomed in on those same spots and shown even more galaxies. And the ones that it can photograph are generally in even more impressive detail. And it's caused all kinds of head scratching for the scientists because it's zoomed out further than ever before. And of course, the further light is traveling to reach us, the longer it's taking that light to travel from its source all the way over to us and to our eyes or to our telescopes. And so the older the pictures that we're looking at. And the idea was that the Webb Space Telescope would be able to look really far back in time and we'd be able to see galaxies evolving and gradually coming together. And you know, clumps of matter coming together and starting to form galaxies. And we'd see like primitive, simple, early galaxies. And that's not the picture. You know, that's what scientists expected to happen. And instead, well, they've got galaxies that are too big to have evolved in that period of time and stars too big. And there's a lot in these pictures that scientists believe show black holes. And they're looking at them and saying, well, there's not enough time for black holes to have coalesced under our standard models of how the galaxy evolved. So it's posing major challenges to their view of the universe, and they're not being challenged enough, really, or they're not thinking deeply enough about these challenges. We'll get to some of that in just a minute. But we've got a lot of incredibly impressive material from the James Webb Space Telescope. Then there's the Vera Rubin Observatory, which came online this year, I think it was, and that fills the opposite niche. It's instead of zooming in on a very narrow area of sky, it zooms way out. And it will give us a wide coverage monitoring the southern sky in real time, allowing us to spot millions of events that would otherwise be missed. It'll be able to track asteroids moving across the sky. It'd be great for finding asteroids because it will be able to see little dots just changing slightly night after night. But it should also spot all kinds of things that we just don't know to look for. We've not had anything that can monitor the sky over this kind of detail before. So the most exciting thing, I think, about the Vera Rubin Observatory isn't, hey, there's this thing we know we want to look at. It's more, what does it turn up that we don't even know to look for? And that's really just getting started. And then you've got the Euclid Space Telescope. That's a little bit like Vera Rubin. It has a wider field of view, not quite as wide, but it aims to go out and it's in space, and Euclid will map and photograph billions of galaxies. just giving us an incredible map of the space around us and all kinds of pictures of galaxies. Now, last week, NASA launched the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. It's named after NASA's first chief astronomer. She's been dubbed the mother of the Hubble Space Telescope. She had a lot to do with that telescope launching. And Roman is going to kind of fill the gap between the James Webb Space Telescope and then Euclid and some of these wider angled space telescopes. And you could almost think of this as kind of 100 Hubble Space Telescopes duct taped together. So it's not like it can see any deeper really than Hubble or see any better than Hubble, but it can take a photograph of a much bigger area. It can bring in 100 times the data basically all at once. You know, the photograph is just as good as the Hubble photograph, but it's 100 times bigger. So its mirror is the same size as Hubble, but obviously since Hubble, the sensor technology and cameras, I mean, Hubble was launched in the early 90s. How much more tech is there in your camera than the camera you had in the early 90s? I mean, you may not even have a camera now. It might all be built into a phone. That sensor technology has changed a lot. So you get the same amount of detail, but each photo is going to be 100 times bigger. So we're getting a whole lot more pictures. Hubble photographed just under 1% of the sky during its 36-year lifetime. Roman is scheduled to cover 12% of the sky in 17 months. It would have taken Hubble 1,700 years to get that kind of coverage. A survey of the Milky Way that would take Roman a month would have taken Hubble 100 years. It will produce more data in 1 year than Hubble produced in its entire lifespan. And Roman's largest survey, where taking pictures over multiple times or covering an area with multiple pictures, it would require 500,000 4K televisions to display it in full quality. That is 45 city blocks covered in TVs. So we're going to get a whole lot of pictures. And having this amount of detail over a wide area, it has some significant advantages, even compared to the Webb telescope. Because the Webb telescope, it can zoom in a long way to photograph distant galaxies, but Roman will be much better at watching for distant events. Kind of like the Vera Rubin Observatory does for the southern sky almost as a whole, where it just continually monitors a big portion of the sky. Well, Roman is going to be able to still zoom in to the extent that Hubble could, so still be able to see pretty far, get these distant images, and then while Webb, because Webb's view is so narrow, it's not great for, say, just looking at that and waiting for something to change, because it's got a pretty narrow, you know, it's focused on a very narrow bit. Roman, with this bigger sensor, with this bigger coverage, with this bigger field of view, it will be able to just then watch this distant period of the sky for changes. And that will help answer questions about some of these galaxies and show us more things about, you know, what is going on here, what whether some of these distant objects, are they black holes? If they are, what type? That kind of thing. So it's going to be carrying out this type of survey work. It's also going to be incredible at photographing exoplanets, planets outside of the solar system. This is really exciting. The kind of the survey ability will mean that it will be great at surveying the Milky Way, looking for planets from outside the solar system. But also it's the first telescope ever that will be able to take a photograph of a planet using the reflected starlight that planet is putting out into space. So in the past, we do have, I think it's a bit under 100 photos, direct photos of exoplanets. Very hard to take photos of because compared to a star, you know, the reflected light coming off a planet is really, really, really faint. So if you've got a star in the shot and you're taking a picture, that star is just going to be really bright and the planet's just not going to show up, completely dwarfed by the star's light. Now, the way that we've got some photos before is not the reflected starlight, but instead the kind of the infrared glow of a relatively hot planet, the heat coming off it. Now, that heat has come from the star, but it's not just the star's light being directly reflected back. And it doesn't really tell us much about, you know, what would this planet look like if we were seeing it with our own eyes. But Roman carries a device called a coronagraph that will be able to block out the nearby star, so that doesn't show up on the picture. Then it can turn up the brightness sensitivity much, much higher and be able to photograph that very faint reflected light coming from that planet. So that's going to be pretty exciting. And NASA is going to use the data they get from that to design a telescope called the Habitable Worlds Observatory that should be even better at photographing exoplanets. But we'll be able to see these planets for the first time. Now, it wasn't cheap. The Roman cost $4 billion. It was finished about 9 months ahead of schedule. It launched last week on a SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket, or I think it was just over a week ago at the weekend before last. It's now traveling to a gravitationally stable point about 1 million miles away from the Earth, about the same position as the JWST. This is another advantage compared to Hubble, because if you're trying to take a photo of Hubble of something specific, it's orbiting the Earth, so the Earth just keeps getting in the way, whereas that's not going to be an issue now with Roman, just like it's not an issue for Webb. And it will take about 100 days to get in position. And once then, it will go through about a three-month testing and calibration period and send us back its first images early next year. Now, there's also some suspicions NASA will pull a rabbit out of the hat around Christmas time, publish some early images. It'd be great to see something like that if they do. Now, Nikki Fox, Associate Administrator for the Science Mission Directorate at NASA, she put out a statement where she said, with its large field of view and fast survey speeds, Roman will usher us into a new era of discovery and make the invisible visible. And that's a pretty exciting quote from the NASA Administrator. It made me immediately think of Romans 1. I mean, I'll read it from the New International Version. That says, for instance, since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. We can know, you know, just any kind of science, any observation. You just look out your window and really it does make the invisible visible. You can see God's invisible power. His invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature. You can clearly see that from what he has made, from the creation. And it doesn't and it shouldn't take a space telescope to see evidence of God's power. That's all around us. But it does give us an even better and even closer look at that power. And this is something that Mr. Flurry spoke about. This same passage, this same point that this NASA administrator was making. All the way back, I think it was around 2009, but he gave a commencement address at the graduation ceremony for Herbert W. Armstrong College, and it was made into a Key of David, and that address was all about the Hubble Space Telescope. And, I'll play you a few clips from that, but this one in particular that ties right into what that NASA administrator was saying.
And you know what the scriptures say in Romans 1? Paul said that you can see the invisible things from the things that are made. And we've never seen more that has been made than we have with this Hubble telescope. They ought to be seeing God out there, but they don't see God. They don't even mention God. I mean, there are many ways to prove God's existence, certainly in large number. And that's one of them, by what he has made and how it works by laws. And we set our watches by it and all of that. Amazing that they won't even entertain the idea that, well, perhaps we ought to, with our theory, include the Bible and what it says about the universe. But Paul said, listen, the invisible things are clearly seen, that is God, the angels, all of it, is clearly seen by the things that are made. And in Romans 1, he says, you are without excuse, because he said, when I showed it to them, they suppressed it. And God is not taking this lightly. And the men of the Bible didn't take it lightly either. Paul said, you have no excuse. Now that's what God is going to say in time to people that disagree with his word. That's what he's going to say. We have so much more today in those pictures from the Hubble telescope. And we teach our students that they're going to be in the vanguard of that instruction in the world tomorrow and help Christ teach the whole world about this vision in Hebrews 2 and verse 8. And they're building the character now, today, that's going to prepare them for that job and that responsibility.
As Mr. Flurry talks about there, well, the NASA administrators, though, they say it's going to make the invisible visible, but they're not talking about God. And they're without excuse. They should know. You know, it shouldn't, like I said, it shouldn't take a space telescope. It doesn't take a space telescope. But again, Fox, she said that she's looking to Roman for help in answering humanity's most profound questions about our cosmic history and setting the foundation for humanity's search for life beyond our solar system. And they're looking to the Hubble. Well, they were looking to Hubble. Now they're looking to Roman. They're looking to these space telescopes to answer the questions that are answered by the Bible.
Some of the scientists believe that the greatest discovery of the 20th century was the Hubble telescope. And it was one of the greatest discoveries and the greatest discovery of any telescope for sure. And these men that are these scientists that are working on that telescope and telling people what it's all about, what it really means for you and for all of us, is not really at all in harmony with what the Bible says. In many cases, it's not. Now, they have done great things, and we want to give them all the credit we possibly can, but we've all paid taxes into that project for NASA. And it seems to me there ought to be a lot more mention about the Bible in that Hubble project, because when they're talking about it, I have never, to my knowledge, read anything about the Bible. And the Bible has a lot to say about that project, in an indirect way, of course. And they'll tell you, if you ask them, well, what is the purpose of the Hubble telescope? Well, that's to discover our origins. Well, now, are they really going to find our origins out on Mars? No, the Genesis chapters 1 through 3 talk about our origins. So this is fundamental teaching from the Bible, and yet the scientists talk about this all the time, and I don't even recall anybody having ever challenged that. They just simply don't do it. Now, we certainly should challenge it.
You know, these telescopes can bring us a lot of wonderful truth, but, well, they're not going to show us our origins in the way that these NASA scientists are talking about now. I mean, I guess, again, you could see proof of the Creator through what He created, in a sense. They show us our origins that way. If they'd look at this creation and say, wow, what an incredible designer, what an incredible Creator we have. But in the way that they're looking for it, no, it's not going to answer those questions. But there is a message that needs to be going out, an exciting message that needs to be going out alongside the pictures, the data, the material that we're getting from the space telescopes. I mean, listen to what Mr. Flurry said. There's a bit of a longer quote from this commencement address about the timing of Hubble launching and us starting to get some of these very first, most groundbreaking, most surprising images from these different space telescopes.
The Philadelphia Church of God began proclaiming its message January 1990. And 4 months later, up went the Hubble telescope. Now, we have been explaining that, really, and talking about it and writing about it for years, and I believe explaining it. But you have two entities here. And do you think maybe the timing there is not coincidence? Because if you're probing deeply into the universe, you can be sure that if God is the Creator, He's concerned about that. He's concerned about what is going on there and what people are saying about it. I think, again, the two entities, that is this church and the Hubble telescope, were timed very closely together. And I don't think that was all coincidence, because that was one of the greatest discoveries of the 20th century in science, and I frankly think it was the greatest. And yet you have a Bible that we talk about all the time that's very up to date. We believe it's really, really up to date. Now look, I'll tell you why I think this is not all coincidence, because that is the PCG sending out its message about the time Hubble sent theirs out. We're living in very dangerous times, the most dangerous times ever on this earth. Black, dark times where human survival is in question, and we wouldn't survive if it weren't for a great God out there. We simply would not survive. I tell you, those pictures, those Hubble telescope pictures, are just screaming out, I believe, for us to explain them to this world and show them where there is all kinds of hope, unbelievable to them in many ways, if they would just put their focus where it ought to be. We talk to our young people about that all the time. And the world's number one need is for hope. And I'll tell you, those Hubble pictures are going to help us to give this world a great deal more hope.
These telescopes are full of all kinds of hope. I mean, they are, in a very real way, a picture of man's future. You could turn to Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 8, where God says, "You've put all things in subjection under his feet." You know, all creation, the universe, as I think it says in Moffat, "For that he put all in subjection under him, he left nothing that is not put under him. But now we see not yet all things put under him." I mean, this is quite clearly not just talking about the earth. Because, well, we do see all the earth put under man. But the all things that God is talking about here and that Paul is writing about in Hebrews 2, we haven't seen man rule over that yet. What's that referring to? It's referring to literally all things, the entire universe. We haven't seen man ruling over that. Here's what Mr. Flurry had to say about this all things, about this universe.
I mean, you can read Hebrews 2 and verse 8, where it talks about God giving us a whole universe. And before Hubble, well, you're limited in what you can see. And of course, even on further back to the time of Paul, when they hardly had any telescopes at all, well, you couldn't see a lot. Maybe that wasn't so impressive. Well, I don't see too much. But with this Hubble telescope, I think it's essential that we see how much more meaningful and inspiring and uplifting Hebrews 2 and verse 8 is with these new pictures. They are truly staggering to the mind. And yet God says, "I'm going to give it all to you. Nothing will be withheld." Under his direction, of course. Now that's for mankind.
And that's really what all of these huge amounts of pictures from the Roman Space Telescope are very soon going to be showing us. Man's future, our future kingdom, what man, when he's born into the God family, will be ruling over and working with and beautifying. There is just enough to set your imagination on fire, as Mr. Flurry talks about. And man doesn't understand this future. He has rejected even all knowledge of God. He's chosen to not keep God in knowledge, in his mind. He's rejected that truth. He doesn't know the truth about his future. Even with all of these images coming through, there's more and more discouragement in this world. We need to be inspired by these pictures, and we have a message that we need to take out to the world, showing them the hope that is here in these dark times that you can get from these pictures once you retain God in your knowledge. And if you'd like more on this, we have our free book, Our Awesome Universe Potential, that's just got all kinds of amazing pictures from Hubble. And we'll take you through these scriptures showing how this is our wonderful future and the hope that is there behind them. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I think Mr. Stephen Fleig will probably be back on the show tomorrow, but it's been a pleasure to come in and guest host and spend some time with you. If you have any questions or comments, you can get in touch with us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Until next time, keep watching your world.